You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
For now, though, it is an absolute delight and an honour to hand over and to introduce your host for this next session. She is the former moderator of the Church of Scotland. She is the current UK and global church ambassador for for Christian Aid around the world. It is an absolute joy to introduce the fantastic Sally Foster Fulton. Big round of applause.
Is that better? Excellent. Before we start, I want to ask you something. I want you to remember a time when you've been forgotten. Maybe it was when you were a kid. Maybe it wasn't too long ago. Maybe you just felt like you'd been forgotten or you hadn't been heard. Or things had moved on without you. What did that feel like? What did it look like walking around in real life? So today we're going to spend some time together and we're going to explore and listen to those voices of folk whose ordeal has been forgotten. And it's easy for that to happen. And it's not a judgment thing. If you look at the world today, we seem to be lurching from one crisis to another crisis to the next. But for the people with the lived experience of extreme poverty, of climate chaos, of oppression and displacement, when we move on to the next thing, they don't. They don't. So we're going to spend some time this afternoon listening. Not listening to me, not listening to experts in their field particularly, but listening to people with lived experience in places where the world has seemed to move on. And I'd like you to remember as we listen that feeling of being forgotten whenever it happened. And it tends to open our ears in a very different way. So the first person we're going to listen to is Michael Mosselmans. He is a wonderful human being. He is Christian Aid's head of humanitarian response, leading the organization's work, supporting people affected by conflict, by disasters, and other humanitarian crises around the world. Michael works alongside local partners to help communities respond to emergencies and build resistance for the future. And as I said in that introduction, Christian Aid works with local communities. Because local communities know what they need far more than we do. They have trust and access in those places that we don't. And it's a hyper-local model. So here's Michael.
Oh, no. Today, humanitarian needs across the world are at record high levels, with 240 million people in need of life-saving support. The three prime drivers of this are continuing severe protracted conflict, including in the Middle East and Africa, coupled with the growing impact of climate change on poor countries, challenging people's livelihoods, coupled with a significant decline in donor funding for humanitarian aid. Donor funding for humanitarian aid is at its lowest level for a decade. And a lot of emergencies tend to be severely underfunded because I think the media cycles tends to favour sudden impact, novel events over long-term entrenched suffering. So public interest tends to follow a trajectory of a spike when there's a specific quick emergency event, followed by a rapid decline as the novelty wears off and fatigue sets in. On top of that, media newsrooms have limited economic resources, and it's difficult for them to access some crises where, for example, there's conflict going on or where there's restricted press freedom. And also, there's so much other stuff going on in the news that the attention of donors and the media and the public very quickly moves on to other things. And, you know, the sad thing is that when funding does run out, local aid providers are forced to curtail or shut down operations, exacerbating suffering for millions of people. And I think there's also a tendency where crises that are in places that are maybe near here, near where the donor governments or the donor public are, attract more attention. We tend to be slightly more interested in stuff that's going on not far from where we live. And, you know, crises that are in countries of significant geostrategic importance, whereas the world's most forgotten crises in, and especially drawn out geopolitical conflicts, are harder to market and harder to sustain government, media, or public interest in. But I think that the worry is that when humanitarian crises fade from public attention and funding drops, then, you know, local aid agencies have to ration or halt life-saving services like providing food, healthcare, and water to the most vulnerable people on the planet, not least women, children, the elderly, the disabled, and people from disadvantaged ethnicities. The good news is that the humanitarian sector as a whole continues to mount massive life-saving operations, as I said, trying to help 90 million people with emergency healthcare, treating child malnutrition, delivering water, and oftentimes providing cash so that vulnerable people can choose for themselves what they most need.
So it's a bit uncomfortable, isn't it, having to listen to those very good reasons why we can't give our attention to everything, because there's simply too much happening. You can't respond emotionally to every headline. But maybe the question isn't whether we can care about everything equally. Maybe the question is, what happens when we stop caring altogether? Because the end of a news cycle isn't the end of a crisis. The cameras may move on, the donations may falter. The headlines may disappear, but the people do not. And that's where I think the Christian challenge becomes real. So another question. Where do we find hope when they do? What might our response be as Christians? We're going to hear now from Bob Kukuyu. Bob is he is ChristianAid's Global Theology Advisor. He's based in Nairobi, Kenya. He brings together faith, theology, and ChristianAid's work for justice around the world. He's helping churches and communities explore what it means to respond to poverty, conflict, and inequality when those three hit together.
It is true that the world is in a crisis, and there have been so many crises that it's possible to become or to develop apathy, or it's possible for our compassion to be short-lived and therefore move on from one crisis and be moved by the next and most immediate crisis. But I think that's where the church has a responsibility to play, and that it would keep alive its sense of compassion, partly because long after the world has moved on, the rest of the world, so to speak, has moved on from one crisis to the next. The pain of those who have been forgotten continues. The pain does not move on with the rest of the world. It's still very present and very real for them in their day-to-day experiences. I would imagine the people of Eastern Congo, some who have never known a place to settle, a place to call home, because they've just been moving from one refugee camp to another. These are the kinds of people who are forgotten. The people in Bangladesh, the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh, they have been forgotten. But their pain continues to this day. Their pain is very, very real. But the church has been called into global solidarity. And this means that if one part of the body feels pain, where there is a church, then the rest of the body suffers with it. And that it is important for us to carry with us in that solidarity the pain of other people, or at the very least, represent or speak about the pain of other people. Because the church, by nature, has been called into global solidarity. If one part of the body suffers, the rest of the body suffers with it, and we need to come to the place where we truly have that experience of being one body, and that our solidarity is strongest in standing with one another in our times of suffering. And so we do not forget, as a global church, we cannot forget those who continue in suffering, even while the rest of the world has moved on from their suffering. But by way of footnote, I would imagine, or I'd like to say, that the greatest crisis is not those who have been forgotten. It's those who were never, ever even considered in the beginning. So they can't even be categorized as the forgotten. I would say the ignored. The people who were not even on the back burner, they were never ever on the burner itself in the first place. For example, the crisis in Darfur in Sudan, the Darfuri people have been forgotten for tens and tens of years because their crisis was never really brought to the front, not until recently, with a massacre that took place by the rebel soldiers, the rapid support forces. Not until this recent, obvious massacre has that crisis come to the fore. But for tens of years, they were never even considered. And I think that's where the greatest crisis is. Not the forgotten, but those who are totally ignored. And how do we bring those people into the vision of the rest of the world? That should have been our responsibility as the church, to forefront that crisis. And that should be what we should do. We should be missional about crisis and look out, as Jesus would look out, for the forgotten. We need to look out for the ones who are away and bring their crisis into the limelight. But I also want to think about where hope lies. And I would imagine that what I've seen as the greatest hope is in those who are in the actual crisis. I have been to refugee camps and I have looked at the pain and suffering of those people. But that's not all that there is to their existence. I have seen people with hope. Hope in God that this too shall come to pass. And I don't understand it, but it is there. And so I find hope in their hope, because their hope has enabled them to develop resilience, but also a heart of gratitude. In the midst of their suffering, they still are grateful for the things that I take for granted. They're grateful that they survived the night. They're grateful for the little that they have to eat. They're grateful that they can see another day. things we take for granted. And for me, my greatest hope has been in seeing the resilience of the people right in the midst of the crisis. But also my hope is very much in how people have responded to those in crisis, that people far away can come, volunteer their time to go to those camps and be part of reaching out to them with their hands and the feet of Jesus. My hope has been in people who have responded during those times of crisis and have seen from far away, some near, with the eyes of Jesus, and not just seen people, but seen people whom God loves, and therefore they want to respond with the same love of God. And they give of their gifts, they give of their time, they give of their resources. I found hope in people who have responded as Jesus would respond. And that is very heartwarming for me. But now when we think about the people in the UK, what would my appeal be? I would say, may your response be not to the crisis per se, but may your response be to people. I recognize I have said this over and over again and still say it. Respond to people. I'm very encouraged by the words of Jesus in Luke. Again, when in a number of versions, with the story of when he looked out on the crowds, he looked on them and saw they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And what did he do? He had compassion on them. And I think we need to see not just refugee camps, we need to see not just bombed out villages, we need to see people. And when we see people, we will respond like Jesus did, that he had compassion on them and he responded to that compassion. In the same way, it would help us, moving on from global solidarity, which I mentioned at the beginning, because in many of these places of crisis, there are people of faith, our faith, Christians, there are people of other faiths, and then there are people of no faith. But all of them, we need to see as Jesus did. We need to see them as people whom God created, people who have been made in his image, and we will respond to them in that sense, in that light. As one singer said, it doesn't matter what color you are, as long as your blood is red. It doesn't matter what color people are. It doesn't matter their creed. As long as their blood is red, we will respond to them as people. That's what Jesus would have done. And so I say to the people in the UK, when you respond to the crisis, when you respond to crisis, respond to people, not necessarily to the crisis. See beyond the crisis and see the people whose dignity has been taken away, whose hope is ebbing, whose hope may be fading, people who just need your response and your touch. People in the UK, respond to people, because people respond to people, not necessarily to crisis. And that's how Jesus would have responded. We can make a difference in the world for people in crisis.
Thanks. 1 Corinthians 12:26 says, if one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. I don't think Paul was talking or writing about international development. He wasn't writing about humanitarian crises. He was talking about the church. But his image of the body gives us something powerful to think about today. Because if we really believe that the church is one body, then suffering isn't something that belongs to somebody else. It belongs to the body. And perhaps one of the ways we live out that belief is simply by refusing to forget. So let's move from the idea of a forgotten crisis to the reality of what it means when one becomes normal. What does hope look like when conflict has become normal? We're going to hear from Bishop Martin Gordon. Bishop Martin is the Anglican Bishop of Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo, a role he's held since 2023. During the escalation of violence in Goma in 2025, Martin became a prominent voice calling for international action for peace through the Goma Call for Peace. He previously worked as international campaigns manager at Christian Aid, where he helped coordinate the Make Poverty History Coalition.
We've known conflict in eastern Congo for about 35 years. It started around the time of the Rwandan genocide, and if it started as an ethnic conflict, it's now morphed into something that's much more focused on minerals and on land. We have around about 120 armed groups operating in the region. And the conflict has come in cycles, and we are now, since 2021, in a new cycle. A rebel group called the M23, who are backed by the neighbouring Rwanda, started to take territory in eastern Congo, and then in January of 2025, they moved into the city of Goma. And so in the days following that, there were thousands of people who were killed on the streets of Goma. And conflict has unfortunately become normalised. So it comes in waves. There are periods of calm and then conflict picks up again. And the government in Kinshasa, which is about 2,000 kilometres away, finds it very, very difficult to fully administer the east of the country. So that is the context of the church. There are so many people that I speak to in Goma who have grown up knowing nothing but conflict. So that is the normal state of the church. But the encouragement for us as a church is that the church is growing. We have a very ambitious program to plant 50 churches in the next 5 years, and we're already well underway. We've planted about 20 in the last 2 or 3 years. And so we see God is at work on the margins and on the edges. And the encouragements are that even when the city fell in January 2025, we saw this as an opportunity to continue with church growth and church planting. So in the north of the city, in a town called Kibumba, and in the west, in a town called Sake, they were the front lines of the conflict. And they had been places that we had been keen to plant churches for quite a long time. And as soon as the M23 rebels were controlling the whole of the region and pretty much all of the diocese, one of the advantages was that we were able to move around more freely. And so we took every advantage that God gave us. So on the front line in Kibumba, we went with humanitarian aid. And as a result of that, the population asked us to come and plant a church. So that's a real sign of hope in a really tough situation. We are now focusing, obviously, on the discipling, the new believers after having baptized them. I'm often asked, what is the difference? How does the church adapt to a conflict zone? And one short answer is that we do what the church does everywhere across the world. We evangelize, we disciple new believers, and we reach out in service and in love to the local community. But one of the differences is that we are focusing increasingly on trauma healing. So wave after wave of conflict means wave after wave of trauma. And this is just one more trauma experience that is layered on top of others. So we've recently been focusing on our schools, our young people, particularly are young women who've often suffered sexual violence that comes with conflict. And one of the challenges is how do you minister to the whole person? How do you not just preach the gospel and strengthen them in faith, but then look at the social and the psychological and also the material needs? How do you bring water to places where there is no water? How do you bring trauma healing to communities that where everyone is traumatized? I was at a meeting recently where a person stood up and said that there is no one in Eastern Congo who is not traumatized. We work across the board. We work with Catholics. We work with the Baptists, the Lutherans, the Kimbanguists, which is a unique denomination rooted in Congo. On certain areas, we'll work very closely together. One of those areas is peace building, is conflict resolution, is social cohesion. But we've also, with the Ebola pandemic, Ebola epidemic that has recently been declared in the last couple of months in Eastern Congo, the churches have again come together to tackle that epidemic. And that's a real sign of hope and a real sign of encouragement for us. We would love you to pray for us. And when I am able to tell the Diocese of Goma and the individual churches and clergy that there are individuals and there are churches in the UK who are praying, who are interested, who are asking questions, who want to know about the church in Goma, they're always incredibly, incredibly encouraged that, and they ask, why would someone who's never heard of us be interested in us and interested in praying for us? But as you do pray for us, there is that sense that we're not forgotten. So as you think of Goma, think of Eastern DRC, as you hear Ebola talked about in the media, please do pray for us. The resilience of the Congolese people in Eastern Congo is incredible. But we're tired. We have been round this cycle again and again and again. With the fall of Goma, there's a UN resolution that calls on the Rwandan troops to leave Eastern DRC, which calls for an immediate ceasefire, that calls for unhindered access for humanitarian work. And what we can also do is to continue to put pressure on governments so that they can put pressure on the Rwandan government and also on the Congolese government to honour the terms of the UN resolution.
I heard something that really struck me. We're tired. I think we need to stop and pay attention to that. Because sometimes when we talk about hope, particularly in these spaces, if we're not careful, we make it sound effortless. Oh, I hope so. Love heart, move on. Rather than hope looking something like this. Hope looking like continuing to serve when you're tired. Hope looking like continuing to heal trauma. Hope looking like different churches who are very different working together. Hope looking like refusing to abandon a community. And maybe that's a really important distinction, that we don't romanticize hope or resilience for that matter, because it isn't found in the denial of reality. It's what enables people to keep working for something better within the reality they're in. We're now going to hear from someone from Myanmar. Myanmar is another place where conflict and disaster have been competing for attention for years. Pan Mayat Mon is Christian Aid's country director in Myanmar, where she leads work supporting communities affected by conflict, humanitarian crises, and climate-related disasters. And hear that trio, humanitarian crises, climate-related disasters, conflict. Not just one thing, just another thing.
Hi, my name is Ben. I work as a program and partnership lead, and I'm based in Yangon. I wish people in the UK understood the overwhelming reality of the current internal conflict and climate-induced disasters in Myanmar, and how deeply it threatens the daily survival of ordinary people and grassroots communities. Families across our country are caught in non-stop conflict, forced to flee their homes, facing aerial bombardments and enduring severe shortages of basic food, shelter, and healthcare. Today, nearly 20 million people, which is one-third of Myanmar's population, need urgent humanitarian aid. Over 3.5 million are displaced, and 50 million face acute hunger, making Myanmar one of the world's most critical hunger hotspots. Women, children, elderly citizens, ethnic minorities, and persons with disabilities carry the heaviest burden. My message to the international community is clear. Please do not look away. We urgently need flexible multipurpose cash assistance, support for local livelihoods, income generation for women-led households, and funding for community-led education, so our children do not lose their futures. Above all, remember that local CSOs, faith-based actors and networks and volunteer groups are delivering 80% of the aid on the ground, especially in hard-to-reach areas. By supporting these local frontline responders, you are directly saving lives. For the second question on where have you seen hope recently? Amidst escalating conflict and widespread displacement across the country, hope is not found in high-level political promises, but in the extraordinary resilience of local communities. Across the country, grassroots volunteers, local CSOs, and faith-based networks continue to step into the gap, delivering over 80% of frontline humanitarian aid. We see hope every day in local initiatives. Neighbors sheltering displaced families, community teachers keeping education alive in temporary learning centers, and youth leaders organizing emergency support and distributions in hard-to-reach areas. Their unbroken spirit demonstrates that even under extreme adversity, ordinary people standing together is our most powerful source of hope. For that third question, what would you ask Christians at Green Bell to pray for or do? So, pray for peace, protection, and resilience across Myanmar, specifically for displaced communities, women, children living in IDP camps and high-risk areas, and the local volunteers who serve on the front line under extreme risks. Please do not let Myanmar become a forgotten crisis and natural disasters. Stand with us by raising awareness in the UK, advocating to decision makers, and partnering directly with local community-led initiatives that provide immediate emergency relief and hope. Your prayers and act of solidarity are a vital reminder that our communities are not alone. Thank you so much.
You know, I hear very often when I go around and talk to groups, how can we help these people? But I want you to listen to the language we just heard. Pan talked about local volunteers. Martin talked about local churches. In a moment, we will hear from someone from Haiti, and Jan will talk about women, young people, and community organizations, the hyper-local, because those with lived experience know far more what is needed than we ever will. They're already acting. What they need is solidarity, resourcing, partnership, and people willing to stand alongside them. So perhaps the question isn't empty, how can we help? But how can we stand together? Our final story comes from Haiti, and John asks us to do something really important, to see Haiti beyond the headline, beyond violence, beyond insecurity, beyond disaster. Because behind every statistic, there's somebody's story. There are people making choices, building relationships, creating peace, and refusing to give up. We hear now from Jean.
Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to share a message from Haiti. My name is Jean Tony Basil, and I work in the field of peace building and community development in Haiti as Cushion Aid staff. Every day, I have the privilege of working with local organizations, community leaders, women, and young people who are striving to build peace under extremely difficult circumstances. At this moment, if there is one thing Irish people in the UK understood, it is that Haiti is much more than the headlines of violence, insecurity, and crises. Yes, Haiti is facing one of the most challenging periods in its recent story. Armed violence has displaced families, disrupted livelihood, limited access to education and health care, and create deep fear and uncertainty for millions of people. But the story of Haiti is not only a story of crisis. It is also a story of resilience. Behind every statistic is a mother determined to keep her children safe. Behind every report of displacement is a community leader organizing support for vulnerable families. Behind every challenge is a network of churches, local organizations, women, and young people working tirelessly to preserve dignity and hope. Irish people understood that many Haitians are not waiting to be saved, but are already leading solutions. What they often lack is not courage, vision, or commitment. What they lack is sufficient support, solidarity, and opportunities to turn local solutions into sustainable change. Despite the difficulties, I see hope regularly in Haiti and these communities where I work. Recently, I have seen hope through the work of local civil society organizations, especially women's organizations in Northeast from these following municipalities: Wanamet, Ferrier, Kapoti, and For Liberty, that continue serving their communities even when conditions are extremely difficult. I have seen women and young organizations leaders engaged to resolve local tension on land conflict. I have seen young people choosing dialogue instead of violence. In the South and Northeast, where I work, I have seen community groups creating safe spaces where people can discuss their fears, their needs, and their aspiration for the future. Hope is not always dramatic. Sometimes hope is simply a community refusing to give up. Hope is a teacher continues to educate children despite insecurity. Hope is a farmer returning to cultivate the land after displacement, even the lack of institutional support. Hope is a church opening its door to support families in need. In my work, I have witnessed grassroots organizations continue promoting peace, social cohesion, and women's leadership even when resources are limited and the environment is uncertain. Those moments remind me that peace is not only an agreement signing at the national or at the local level. Peace is built every day by ordinary people making extraordinary choices. I would like to take this moment to ask questions at Green Bell's two things. First, I will ask you to pray. Pray for the safety of Haitian families. Pray for children and young people whose futures are being shaped by the current crisis. Pray for community leaders, churches, humanitarian workers, and civil society organizations who continue serving others despite significant risk and challenges. Pray also for a just and sustainable peace, not simply the absence of violence, but the presence of dignity, opportunity, inclusion, and hope. But I will also ask you to do something. Stay informed about Haiti beyond the headlines. Listen to Haitian voices. Support organizations that work alongside local communities. Advocate for policies and partnerships that strengthen local leadership and long-term peace building. Recognize that solidarity is not charity. Charity is standing with people as they pursue their own vision for peace and justice. Most importantly, do not forget Haiti. In times of persistent crisis, one of the greatest risks is that suffering becomes invisible. Yet every act of attention, every prayer, every partnership, and every expression of solidarity sends a powerful message. Haitian people in Haiti, you are not alone. As Christians, we share a belief that hope can emerge even in the darkest moments. That belief is not abstract for us in Haiti. It is something we live every day. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your prayers. And thank you for walking alongside the people of Haiti as we continue the difficult but essential work of building peace. May God bless you, and may God bless Haiti.
So we've heard about people choosing dialogue instead of violence, people opening their doors, people continuing to serve, people choosing hope when it's really hard. So what about us? What role does the church have to play in all of this? We're now going to hear from Graham Gordon. Graham is Christian Aid's ecumenical lead, working to strengthen relationships with churches and ecumenical partners across the UK and globally. Graham is passionate about helping the church respond to injustice and stand alongside the communities facing poverty, conflict, and climate-related crises. I also need to warn you, you're not slipping into an alternative dimension. Graham is Martin Gordon's twin brother. And the first time I saw this video, I got very confused.
So why is the church uniquely placed to respond to forgotten global crises, whether they be war, climate crises, or malnutrition? I think there are four reasons why the church is really well placed. The first is that the church is embedded in communities. It knows the people, it knows who is most in need and can make sure that everyone is reached. Secondly, the church is often trusted as a local mediator, church groups or church leaders who can bring groups together and try and tackle conflict. Thirdly, the church is a global body. So if there are issues in one part of the world, church can mobilize the rest of the body around the world to bring about pressure, prayer and support from around the rest of the world. And finally, the church is well placed because the church has a long-term and a spiritual perspective. So firstly, the church is well placed because it is rooted and embedded in local communities and has been there often for decades, if not centuries. Because we work through partners who have that local reach, that local knowledge of communities so that everyone could get the humanitarian aid that was needed, could be looked after, could be brought to safety and security when necessary. I recently visited the church in Brazil and the Anglican church there in the Amazon, visits local indigenous communities and works with them hand in hand to tackle the crisis of land management, of malnutrition, of work. And it knows the communities well because it has that reach into them. Secondly, the church is really well placed to engage in some of these forgotten crises or conflicts because it is trusted. The church is embedded in the local community, and because the church is often working for the common good of the wider community, not just for its own members, it's trusted by those within the church and outside of the church. So in the Kano district in Sierra Leone, Christian Aid has partners who've worked with cattle herders to overcome the impasse that they got to. They got to a situation of cattle rustling where the response was fines or the blame game or punishment and conflict within the communities. They brought together these different herder communities to try and understand what the issues were and to come to a solution of land management, of understanding the other community's needs, and of building together common solutions. Desmond Tutu is well known to many of us as leading in the truth and reconciliation work in South Africa. And he is a church leader who was respected at the highest national level and globally because he could bring around a focus of reconciliation, of forgiveness, and of positive solutions after such a long-term conflict in South Africa. Not ignoring justice that was needed, but actually being able to look to the future and trying to change the narrative. And church leaders are often in that situation as trusted brokers. And even in situations where the church is a minority, like in Myanmar, you have the Catholic Bishops' Conference who were asked by Muslim and Buddhist groups to mediate conflict that they had between their different religions. The third area that the church plays a distinctive role in mediating or addressing conflicts is because it's a global player. So if there's a conflict in one part of the world, church can mobilize the global community to respond and to put pressure in other parts of the world. In South Sudan, after 15 years of independence, there are going to be elections later on in the year. And the regional church under the All Africa Conference of Churches, together with the Anglican Communion and many other denominations, are organizing a peace retreat for the leaders and also a visit to the UK so that the leaders of the South Sudanese Council of Church can ask the UK government, can work with the UK churches to bring around the kind of pressure and support that's needed in South Sudan for a peaceful transition. And finally, the church is well placed because we have a spiritual and a long-term perspective. And I think the church has that extra tool, maybe the foundational tool of bring about change, which is prayer and seeking God's intervention in the situation here. And also the church has a long-term perspective through the suffering, through the difficulties. So say in Colombia, which has been conflict for 70 years, or Sudan or South Sudan or Israel and Palestine, ongoing conflicts. And that perspective, that eternal perspective, recognizes that it's God who's bringing about his kingdom. And that looking back, the Babylonian Empire disappeared, the Roman Empire went. Some of the empires we see, or some of the leaders now, we need to remind ourselves that they will come and they will go, but God's word will continue. God's people will continue to bring about the kingdom as God has called us to do.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.